afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. And it's starting out as an episode, because I'm calling
our
guest.
Don't make it an episode. Come on.
Oh, you got him already? Oh, I'm calling him on his own.
Yeah, see, you got to be positive.
Oh, hey, yeah. I'm sorry.
What have we talked about?
Well, tell him I'm sorry. I was calling him on his other phone. I don't know. You know, when you plan things like, I don't know, a few weeks in advance, and then...
And then all of a sudden, it's upon you.
Well, and then you're, you know, gone for a week, and then you race in, and it's like, oh, he's not picking up. I'm like, no.
I'm there. I'll save you.
All we're going to have to talk about is the unpleasantness of the masks. It's hell being a mask hole, by the way. In the San Francisco Bay Area, I just want you to know if you really, really want to, well, like if you're itching for a fight, as they say, like that's the place to go because you really don't have to do anything at all.
No, you don't.
You don't have to be rude. You don't have to be like, you know, kind of chesty about the whole thing. You just like walk in and, you know, with your, well, Bill's mask was askew. Mostly it was under his chin. And I wasn't wearing one at all. And this very large woman, I was ordering dinner to go, obviously, because everything is to go. And the woman never even asked me about it because they're lovely at Black Bear Diner. Three cheers for Black Bear Diner. Woo, woo, woo. Down in the Bay Area, they are the greatest. And up here in Redding, too. And everywhere else, for that matter. But same owners. And the gal was just very nice to me. The only place I've ever been down there, actually, where they were nice. And all of a sudden, fight breaks out.
I wasn't itching for a fight.
I turn around and Bill has picked the largest Karen in the room to duke it out with. She was, as they say, a weighty opponent. Yeah. Yeah, it was quite something.
Yeah, it was.
So Ashley informed me today was National, what is it, American Family Day. How does that prefigure into this? I think we should change it.
Well, I got all my hate and discontent out. So I should...
You
I
moved
should
be, that all...
I did. I got it all...
Moved it all down the trail?
Got it all down the trail. I should be good to go today.
Well, with that inauspicious beginning. So my name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Now you know where to find us.
Yeah. And you probably won't recognize... Well, you will recognize us because there probably won't be a mask, but...
yeah, actually, we'll be the ones
anymore,
you
don't know who you're talking to because all you see is a mask and sunglasses. So
people you actually know, they say hi and you're like...
Actually, a great era to be a bank robber.
Yeah, remember when that was not legal to do? You couldn't go into a bank with a mask on?
Yeah.
I'd like to be a bank teller, actually.
What do you look like? He looked like that guy, and that guy, and that guy.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So
who's our sponsor?
Well, I was just going to say that.
Oh,
that was my part, and then you get the other part, unless you want me to mess up the commercial again.
Oh, no, don't do that. All right, let's start over.
Because I do love doing that. All right.
So...
Pull the ripcord, Bill. I'm not even looking at
our sponsor. Our sponsor today is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They are tearing it up on the tractor sales down there. If you're looking for a tractor, you better hurry up and get one because, believe it or not, nationwide inventories are very low right now.
Because nobody has anything better to do to drive tractors around.
The coronavirus,
and
people are out there.
You don't have to wear a mask on your tractor. You do in your car, apparently.
Yeah, you do have to wear
one. But not on your tractor.
And on your bike in the park.
And on your bike in the park.
You have to have a mask on, but not riding your tractor. So go by and see them. They have a full line of John Deere equipment to choose from. And also, they're a steel dealer. So if you need a chainsaw or a weed trimmer or a hedge trimmer, they got it all down there in stock. And also, the heat's upon us. The wind's going to start blowing, and PG&E is going to thaw out your turkey for you. So you're going to want a generator.
So you can keep your turkey till Thanksgiving?
That's right. And they've got a full line of Honda generators in stock. So go by and see them. They're at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. You can call them at 226-9226 or get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da.
There you go.
So you can find anything and everything about the show, including our phone numbers. So, you know, if you really feel the need to call or text, our phone numbers are right on there. It's wethepeopleradio.us. So apparently I speak too fast sometimes, so that's wethepeopleradio.us. And also, another thing I need to add is that our good friend Robert here is running video on this radio program, which to people listening on the radio might not make any sense, but the American Uncensored Network on KRDT, channel 23.10, is airing the radio program Tuesday and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. So we're not only bothering people on Sunday afternoons, but we're bothering them on television Tuesday and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m., which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the other half of our audience is outside the country, and we had a lot of people in Russia this last month. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm always curious, you know, how that all breaks out, but by topic.
I had an interesting conversation with a Russian truck driver last week. Well, it wasn't really a conversation.
I was going to say, that's not the story I was told.
Yeah, that didn't go real well. But I guess because I didn't speak Russian and he didn't understand
English. And he was wearing flip-flops and wouldn't get out of his truck. Yeah, since when did truck drivers start wearing flip-flops? That's really odd to me.
Yeah.
So, anyway, there you go. That's all the announcements. And our guest today is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and I've posted a few of his articles on here because since I read the first article, there have been a couple of them more. So the first article I saw was China's No First Nuclear Action or Nuclear Fiction. I really should move my computer so I'm not reading it through the microphone thing. Here we go. And then the other two, so I posted that long form on the site, and then I attached China EMP threat. And also Beyond Hiroshima. So he may touch on some of those. And back to the top of my little screen here. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, in case you have been, say, sleeping and never heard our program before, he's the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and the director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both of those are congressional advisory boards. He served on the Congressional EMP Commission, that's Electromagnetic Pulse, for those of you who are not acronymers, and the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, and also the House Armed Services Committee. He was an intelligence officer with the CIA, responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy, which is why he talks about nuclear things a lot. And then just for good measure, he has a PhD in history and archaeology and another one in strategic studies, which is what led him to the CIA. He's author of numerous books, and I've actually included those on the web, too, like on our site for today. And today actually happens to be August the 2nd, 2020, in case we air this on a different time period. And maybe we're not all wearing masks then, and people are like, what the heck are they talking about? So his most recent one is called The Power and the Light, the Congressional EMPs Commission War to Save America, 2001 to 2020. And just in case you need a flashier title, the other one I have highlighted at the top here is Apocalypse Unknown. The struggle to protect America from an electromagnetic pulse catastrophe and electric Armageddon. So, you know, if you're up for some light reading in the evenings, there you go. Two fabulous options and other choices below. So, Dr. Pry, in case you don't want to identify yourself with us, although I know from our emails that you are also now going to be characterized as a mask hole, which is apparently what they like to call us no-mask wearers. How's that working out for you in Virginia?
Well, thank you so much for having me, and I apologize for being late.
No, it's no worries.
It's been a very busy.
My heart's good.
Busy Sunday.
Really?
And yes.
Things that are fun or things that are yucky?
Well, you know, I had there was another. This being the 75th, the upcoming 75th anniversary of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki atomic bombings. There have been a couple of articles I've been working on, including one that I didn't have a chance to send you that was just published in The Hill this morning on Sunday.
Oh.
And, you know, just going back and forth with the editors, you know.
Oh.
You know, right. I have the vanity to think that they ought not to be making editorial changes to my articles. You know, I'm very.
Yeah.
I put a lot of effort into not just my articles, but to the titles, and I managed to convince the editor to just go along with what I wrote, and instead of adding some of their bright ideas, you know, that they want. You know, you send in an article that is a particularly good article, and everybody wants to make their little contribution to it. You know.
Yeah. Right.
And it doesn't always improve it.
What did you want to call it? Because now I'm curious.
Well, the article, for example, that you received, you know, was called Beyond Hiroshima. And, you know, the point being that, and they wanted to change the article to, they wanted to title the article something like Hiroshima Lessons in Peace and Strength 75 Years Later.
Oh, my gosh, that's incredibly catchy.
That was so close to what
you rolls right off your tongue.
Yeah.
Well, you know, but the point is, once you read the article, you know, the theme of my article is that, yes, Hiroshima was an inhumane and extremely destructive act, although war itself is, and there were non-nuclear things like the firebombing of Tokyo that actually killed more people than Hiroshima and Nagasaki did. And I was defending what happens is, to back up here, and the reason I wrote the article, the reason I've been writing several articles, actually, on the Hiroshima and Nagasaki, this is anniversary, the 75th anniversary, is every year, but particularly this year, because it's the 75 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the anniversaries will be on August 6th for Hiroshima and August 9th for Nagasaki. You know, the left and the anti-nuclear activists. And it's going to be especially true this year because of the revolution we've got going on in the country. They'll always point to this not just as a sign of the evils of nuclear weapons and why the United States should ban the bomb and give up our bombs and set up an example for the rest of the world to follow. But this will also clearly fit into the narrative that America is inherently, and our Americans and our leaders are callous, inhumane, and racist.
Of course.
And that Hiroshima and Nagasaki are perfect illustrations of that. And so I wanted to, so these articles are going to try to counterbalance some of that fiction, you know, by pointing out the necessity of the atomic bombings, even though they were extremely inhumane.
Let's take a really quick break, and then when we come back, let's pick that right up. And also, if you want to send me the article, oh, maybe you can't until they already publish it, but when they do, how about this? I'll add it to the website.
I know you've got Beyond Hiroshima.
I do have that one.
Already. Right. Cool. It's the other one that that I haven't sent to you that was in the Hill.
All right. And, well, when I get it, I will add it just in case people are not listening on Sunday, maybe Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, something online.
Sure.
Where you can find us always at wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart.
I love that song. Okay, back to Hiroshima. I wrecked it. I wrecked the whole show. I killed it. Dr. Pry, are you in there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, there he is.
Okay. Go ahead. We were talking about Hiroshima.
Right, about the necessity of the atomic bombings.
Correct.
You know, academics argue endlessly. And they've nearly got most Americans convinced every year that it wasn't necessary to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that's just a fantasy, you know, that's been created and reinforced by universities and colleges that have been taken over by the left that promote this this fantasy. And in the article, I just tried to provide a little bit of evidence on the other side. For instance, you know, I quote in Beyond Hiroshima John Hersey's famous book. You know, he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, and he won the Pulitzer for writing this book called Hiroshima in 1946, where he interviewed six Hiroshima survivors. And he's often quoted around this time of year the passages that describe the horrors of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. You know, the radiation burns and blindness, people walking like zombies, leaving the city, those who survived. And that's the image of nuclear conflict and what nuclear weapons are all about that are burned into the imaginations of most Americans, and why Americans don't like to think about nuclear weapons and why they're so unpopular. But there's another passage in Hershey that's almost never reported, which proves the fanaticism of even Japanese students and college professors. There was a father and son. The father was a university professor at the Hiroshima University of Science, Literature and Science, and his son was a student going to a university in Tokyo, and they both happened to be trapped in their house. The house had collapsed after the atomic bombing at Hiroshima. The house had collapsed on them, and they were trapped under the they were on the first floor, and they were trapped under the debris of the second floor, and the house had caught on fire, and it was burning down around them. But they managed to survive, and described the aftermath. Described that while this was going on, they had basically decided to pledge their deaths as sacrifices to the emperor, and both saying "banzai, banzai, banzai," as the house burned down. But they managed to escape from that situation miraculously and survived. And afterwards, the professor hadn't changed his mind about that. And when interviewed, said that he had not realized that they were so fortunate to be Japanese. And he had not realized up until that moment the sweetness of being able to sacrifice one's life for the emperor. All right? This is a guy who's a professor at a university for literature and science, not a member of the brainwashed Imperial Japanese Army. And that if you're going to look at Hershey, look at all the evidence. And that proves that the assessment of President Truman and the Joint Chiefs were right. Especially after the experience of the battles of Iwo Jima and Okinawa, where there are two tiny islands, that were in that we engaged in the island hopping campaign. They were the last stops before the big invasion of the big islands that make up the Japanese home islands. And to take Iwo Jima and Okinawa cost 88,000 American casualties, 88,000 of them. And it cost the Japanese over 200,000 dead, both military and civilian. Thousands of them died by their own hand. So the estimates that came out of that were that if we were to try to take the Japanese home islands, it was going to cost us probably about 1 million American casualties and several million Japanese casualties. And the several million Japanese casualties is probably an underestimate, because Iwo Jima and Okinawa were virtually depopulated of Japanese after those battles. Most of them would rather die than surrender, just like that university professor and his student son. So we're looking at an incredible Holocaust. And just by the numbers, not only one could argue that it was the humane thing to do to force Japan to surrender to the atomic bomb, which cost, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki together, cost about 100,000 lives, all right? But just the battles of Okinawa and Iwo Jima cost more than that, twice as many. So in terms of the humanitarian interest for both saving the lives of American servicemen, which the president, as commander-in-chief, President Truman, was obligated to do, even if it wasn't better for the Japanese, he should have done that. Even if it would save a few American lives or one American life, that his priority is in saving American lives. And one could argue that he should have done it for that reason, and I would argue that that is so too. But the fact of the matter is that even for the Japanese interest, in terms of sparing their lives, it was the right thing to do. And I go beyond that, because nuclear weapons are not just about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, there are other dates that never come up in these discussions. You know, every year we can always talk on the August 6th and August 9th. We always end up talking about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But there are other dates we never talk about. But we should, if you're going to be fair and balanced and have a real intellectual discussion about nuclear weapons and the role they play in international security. We never talk about May 12, 1949, for example, which was the peaceful end of the USSR's illegal Berlin blockade that threatened to become World War III, but didn't, thanks to U.S. nuclear deterrence. We don't talk about July 27, 1953, which was the armistice ending the Korean War, achieved by President Eisenhower, threatening to use tactical nuclear weapons. We don't talk about that. Just imagine, just those two dates alone, you know, saved more lives than were lost in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, ending the Korean War and avoiding a nuclear World War III with the USSR. But there's more. We don't talk about October 28, 1962, even though movies have been made about this, always to glorify John F. Kennedy and his Camelot administration. Somehow nuclear weapons never get credit for October 28, 1962, which was Kennedy's peaceful end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the USSR agreed to withdraw nuclear missiles from Cuba, and this was achieved only because the United States had a 5-to-1 superiority in ICBMs. You know, the Cuban Missile Crisis is an example of why it's a good thing, you know, to have a classic example, I would say, of peace through strength, you know. And when, and I would also add that maybe we should rethink this whole idea about arms control that wants parity between the United States and potential adversaries like Russia and China. You know, maybe we should be looking at strength and having superiority over adversaries. Well, John F. Kennedy had it back in 1962.
Well, that was also Ronald Reagan's big point, too, was peace through strength.
And he was right.
And he was absolutely right.
And he was absolutely right.
Yeah.
When we come back, since you're an expert on this particular topic, let's not leave this without discussing where we are in relation to the rest of the world at this point on,
well, let me just
on that front. Oh, okay.
Before we leave it.
All right.
Because we don't talk about Ronald Reagan and November 9th, 1989, which was the peaceful fall of the Berlin Wall. Shortly afterwards, the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact that for decades threatened to overrun NATO, but did not do so because they were deterred by U.S. nuclear weapons. And then last, and perhaps most importantly of all, we don't talk about December 21st, 1991, which was the peaceful dissolution of the evil empire was the USSR,
mm-hmm.
without a nuclear World War III. And the last date, that last date above, December 21st, 1991, is especially worth remembering, because it is miraculous and unprecedented in history that two such ideologically opposed and hostile military superpowers refrained from a great war thanks to nuclear deterrence. So those are other dates that we need to remember, not just the dates of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, the existence of the invention of nuclear weapons is considered by many a blessing. Now, I don't consider it that, but one could make a rational argument that they have been. But yes, go on. And
celebrate capitalism if we have to, if we must.
Talk about the history, but talk. You wanted to talk about where we are today.
Yeah, let's. We've got to take a really quick break here, and we will be right back. It seems to happen faster and faster. When we talk about really in-depth topics, it's like, oh, it's time for a break again, sorry. You are listening to We the People. You can find us, actually, if you live in the Reading area, you can find us on KRDT channel 23.10, Tuesday and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m., or any old time on the web at wethepeopleradio.us. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's
of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Blinded by the light.
It's kind of hard to find atomic bomb songs, but turns out there are some after all.
That was close.
That was close.
So where are we today with the nuclear nuclear strategy?
Well, I'm always impressed by your ability to find songs and humor on these rather depressing subjects. But
it's my superpower.
Where are we today? Well, we have not learned. We've forgotten. Washington has forgotten the lessons of the Cold War that enabled us to win the Cold War without it becoming a thermonuclear World War III. That's my view of it, and it's the view of most of my colleagues. We've talked before on the show about how the Obama administration, and really every administration since the end of the Cold War in 1991, neglected the U.S. nuclear deterrent. And even today, even now that President Trump has tried to modernize the nuclear deterrent and is starting to spend money, the first president, you know, since 1991 to try modernizing the nuclear deterrent, it hasn't happened yet, and it's not going to happen for a decade. We are so far behind. You know, the delivery vehicles we've talked about before on the show, you know, our bombers, our missiles, our ballistic missile submarines, and the missiles that they carry were all built back in the Cold War, 30, 40 years ago. You know, and they're really antiques. And the weapons that they carry are equally old and haven't been tested in 25 years. And they were designed for a different strategic environment. And that's probably the greatest weakness in President Trump's nuclear modernization plan, which he basically, the plan he's got was inherited from the Obama administration. It was promised to the Senate if they would sign the new START treaty. Obama dangled that out there as a carrot. Sign the new START treaty. This is a new treaty that supposedly reduced the numbers of nuclear weapons, long-range strategic nuclear weapons on the sides between Russia and the United States to 1,500 apiece. So they would have 1,500 long-range strategic weapons, and we would have 1,500 long-range strategic weapons. Now, a lot of experts don't believe the Russians adhered to the treaty and have been cheating on that treaty, just like they cheated on the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, you know, which gave them an advantage because they have intermediate-range missiles that can reach Europe and Asian allies of the United States, and we don't have any missiles to counter that. And just as they cheated on the nuclear weapon treaty, or the agreement called the Presidential Nuclear Initiative, where both sides were supposed to get rid of their tactical nuclear weapons, we almost did. We reduced our arsenal of tactical nuclear weapons from 15,000 down to, you know, about 180 that are operational. We might have 500 if you stretch it and count those that are stockpiled and ready to be dismantled, okay? But in terms of those that are actually operationally deployed so they could be possibly useful in the theater, you know, it's about 180 of them out in NATO Europe. And the Russians didn't do that. They cheated on that agreement, too. So now they have an at least 10-to-1 advantage in tactical nuclear weapons. 10-to-1. They have thousands of tactical nuclear weapons. And overall, if you count the overall numbers of nuclear weapons, you know, they have an overall advantage of at least 3-to-1. We never allowed that to happen in the Cold War, where they would have an advantage in any category of nuclear weapon. Now, the modernity of their delivery vehicles, their bombers, missiles, ICBMs, ballistic missile submarines, they're all new. they're all they've deployed new systems that have no counterparts, both weapons and delivery vehicles, no counterparts at all in our arsenal. They have, for example, we've talked on the show about third generation nuclear weapons, which are designed, for example, to be, some of them are clean battlefield weapons that produce no fallout, so that you could use it just like a conventional weapon, except it's really much more powerful. So you could take out a bridge or a company or a division of NATO tanks without causing any fallout. They've got what we've talked about a lot on this show, super EMP weapons that are just designed to make EMP, and with one weapon you could fry the North American electric grid. They've got weapons that are designed for producing X-rays, which are good for anti-missile and anti-weapon systems. They fry they could fry our retaliatory forces, you know, out in outer space and intercept them that way. They've got this thing called the Poseidon. We've talked about it too. This doomsday machine. Okay, I mean it's an autonomous submarine with artificial intelligence that's designed to roam around the oceans, and it's got 100 megaton nuclear weapon in it. You know, this is 10,000 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. 10,000 times.
Wow.
You know, and the Russians say it's designed to detonate off our coasts and cause radioactive tidal waves, because most of our population is located off the coast. And so it would be a doomsday weapon in that sense. I think possibly that's a mission, but I think it's more likely. You know, they've described a number of purposes for it, but the one obvious one that they don't talk about, and this is what I think it's really for, is to go after our ballistic missile submarines. You know, the one thing they weren't able to do in the Cold War, they got enough missiles that were sufficiently powerful and accurate so they could have taken out our land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles. They could do a first strike against that. They could also wipe out our bombers. They could do that. And they could take out our ballistic missile submarines that are in port. On a day-to-day basis, most of our submarines are not at sea, but they're usually at port, about two-thirds of them. But they were never able to crack the problem of how to get those ballistic missile submarines that are on patrol at sea. And the Poseidon might finally solve that problem for them, because a 100-megaton warhead, if it's used like a big depth charge, you know, it's got a lethal radius against submarines of well over 100 kilometers. So you just have to know roughly where that submarine might be located in order to get it. And they happen to be planning to deploy 32 of them. You know, that's enough to have two Poseidons trailing each of our ballistic missile submarines, even when all of them are deployed, and enough to have two on all the French and British ballistic missile submarines, too. So that number, 32, which is an interesting number to choose for deploying, because it just happens to match up with the U.S. and Allied ballistic missile submarine fleet. And that would finally check the box and solve all their problems. So where we are in terms of the strategic nuclear balance, and we've also got another problem, because we didn't have to worry about China during the Cold War. China was actually so afraid of the Soviet Union that they were our ally. Bit of history, that happened after 1969. There was a thing called the Ussuri River Crisis, where China and the Soviet Union got in a small spat, a military conflict, a border conflict, over where was the border between China and the Soviet Union in the Far East. And there was some fighting between the two. And Kosygin, who was the premier of the Soviet Union, the dictator of the Soviet Union at the time, asked President Nixon what would the position be of the United States if the Soviet Union decided to take out China in a nuclear strike. And that's why Nixon opened the door to China, saw that as an opportunity to basically establish a strategic partnership and alliance against the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And that's what it became. That's why, you know, we really didn't have, after the Korean War, after 1969, China actually became a partner of the United States. And it was one of the reasons why, after the Cold War, a lot of presidents and Washington thought that, well, China can be our friend, you know, if we bring them, give them all these favorable economic deals and everything, that we can turn them into a democracy, you know, and communism will fall or go away the way it did in the Soviet Union, and we can make them a true strategic partner. And that didn't work out that way, of course. But now we do have to worry about China. Everybody now, I think, understands that China is not our friend. The hope that they would become a strategic partner is a false one, that they've been biding their time. You know, China thinks in terms of centuries, you know, that they've been biding their time so that they could gain economic and military and nuclear advantages over the United States so that they could displace us as the dominant power in the world order. And so we don't have to just worry about Russia anymore. We also have to worry about China. And we've never really paid that much attention to the China's nuclear capabilities the way we did with Russia. You know, we've been trusting these panda hugger analysts, you know, at the Department of State and in our government. Year after year, they say, yeah, well, China's only got 300 nuclear weapons that can reach the U.S. homeland. And that is becoming more and more in dispute. I've written some articles.
Well, and it's, and you know, I think for anybody who, you know, was buying that fiction, they were probably also buying the fiction that, you know, having them manufacture a whole bunch of our pharmaceuticals and all that, no big deal. What could go wrong, you know, and everything else. We've got to take one last quick break. We're going to come back, and we have our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, as a captive for our second hour as well. So we're not going to rush and slam this together here in the next 15 minutes. We've got time. So you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Dr. Pry, at some point I had a question here during the break about the seeds that are coming from China. I guess they're being labeled as jewelry, and they're kind of big, like maybe could be beads or something, and they show up in bubble mailers, and I guess they're kind of just being randomly mailed to people. Do you know about that?
No, I don't. I've heard about it.
Yeah, I'd heard about it too.
I don't know any more about it than you do, I think.
All right. Anyway,
I'd like to
curious. So
I'd
keep
like
going.
To follow up on the excellent question your colleague had asked.
Go,
and
Bill.
I have to say, as a side listening to your commercials here, that you know, I think I would live a longer life and be much happier if I could get a job walking dogs or being a cat psychiatrist. But
no
unfortunately,
kidding.
Fate didn't have that in mind. But the status, where are we in terms of the balance? I've talked about, oh, the fact that we've broken the rules of the Cold War, forgotten the lessons of the Cold War in Washington, and have allowed at least Russia and probably China and even North Korea to get significant advantages over us. I say even North Korea, you know, certainly we have a lot more weapons than North Korea has, but even they have got a super EMP weapon, and we don't have anything like that. And so across the board, you know, we have allowed serious vulnerabilities and imbalances to arise and don't have parity anymore, and in terms of the numerical thing. But there's a more profound, a rather deeper answer to the question about the status and why we are here in it. And this is why I part company with most of my conservative colleagues who see nuclear weapons as sort of as a blessing. Okay, I think that they were a necessity in the emergency of the aftermath of World War II, when our European allies were broken by World War II and they couldn't defend themselves, and we were the last man standing, basically, except for the Soviet Union. And yet they had these overwhelming advantages in terms of the ground forces, so that they could have swept over NATO Europe and basically conquered the world themselves, except for us, were it not for nuclear deterrence. And so nuclear weapons were a emergent, and nuclear deterrence was an emergency measure that we had to implement. We had no choice but to do it in the face of this totalitarian giant, you know, that was threatening the free world, and that itself acquired nuclear weapons, and that we got in an arms race with them. And fortunately, the Great Generation calculated correctly that if we could exercise nuclear deterrence to contain them long enough, that the internal contradictions of communism, because it's basically based on lies, you know, would cause the system to fall apart. And they would fall apart because their economy couldn't support their excessive military spending. And an unfree system, basically, also just, you know, unless you're constantly exercising oppression, you know, that eventually that would cause the system to collapse. And that's what happened. But the wrong lesson, I think, that a lot of conservatives have drawn from the Cold War, and the left too, actually, is that, well, deterrence worked, you know, during the Cold War, so it can work forever. And it can work for against countries like North Korea and Iran, and so we don't have to worry about these guys getting the bomb. You know, we can go on forever and avoid a nuclear war, and we'll be fine. So nuclear weapons, in that sense, are a blessing. And I think that that is untrue, and it's untrue for a number of reasons. You know, first of all, if you look at the history of the Cold War, I mean, I mentioned just a few of the close calls we had, where fortunately nuclear war was deterred by nuclear weapons. But there have been many more close calls than that. I wrote a whole book about some of them called War Scare, Russia and America and the Nuclear Brink, that talks about some of them. And we've talked about some of them on this show. But those of us who had a front row seat to the greatest show on earth that was the Cold War saw nuclear deterrence almost fail many times. And 75, so we've had nuclear deterrence work, quote-unquote, for 75 years at this point, you know, after Hiroshima. But 75 years is not a long time in the span of history. Hmm. You know, every war that has ever been fought is an example of deterrence failure. Every war that has ever been fought, both before and after the invention of nuclear weapons, is an example of deterrence failure. I believe that someday nuclear deterrence will fail if we continue to rely on this. It can fail by accident. It almost has already many times. It can fail because the other side thinks it's got advantages like they have right now with Russia, possibly China, even North Korea. And you know, and this is the point I wanted to get to about what, especially why nuclear weapons are not really a blessing, not for the free world, not for democracies, I think the fundamental reason, why is it that Washington didn't maintain at least parity with Russia and let this happen where they've gotten all these advantages? Well, the short and easy answer is that nuclear weapons are unpopular with democracies and with people. You know, we don't like the idea of holding mass destruction over the heads of other countries. We don't like Hiroshima's and Nagasaki's. And so they're unpopular. But there's a more, and that is true, but there's rather a more profound answer to it than that. You know, because the free world states that derive their legitimacy from the people, the whole idea of weapons of mass destruction, weapons that are designed to destroy cities and peoples, you know, they're antithetical to the concept to democracies that derive their legitimacy from the people. They're also antithetical to our civilization, which, even though Black Lives Matter would disagree and Antifa would disagree, is still rooted in Judeo-Christian values, which favor life over death and believe in just war theories, that the use of violence should be proportional. You know, the one of the reasons we argue still and feel guilty over Hiroshima and Nagasaki is that the killing of civilians, you know, is not okay under long-standing rules of war from Judeo-Christian civilization. And so these fundamental plate tectonic problems with nuclear weapons in our civilization always has created a condition that this particular kind of technology is not one that we're going to be able to always get the political will to keep up with the bad guys. And they don't have the same problem that we do, the same ideological problems that we do with nuclear weapons. Totalitarian states love nuclear weapons for the very reason we hate them. You know, they're the ultimate technological manifestation of might makes right. And if it comes down to it, they're the most efficient way of erasing democracies, their chief rivals. That's why they display them in public. They parade them in their public squares. They have every year, you know, have military and part of the nuclear missiles are part of their military parade, celebrating the might and power of their political leaders and the fact that they can do us in with these weapons if they wanted to. And that's why they also are willing, these totalitarian states, people will say here in the West, well, surely, you know, they value their population too, don't they? But they don't value their population as much as we do. You know, they do not derive their legitimacy from the people. They derive their legitimacy from their particular ideology and from the revolutionary vanguard that is supposed to be almost a race apart. You know, these brilliant geniuses and technocrats that run their societies, they are the ones that are most valued, not the people. And this is true. You can look at it by the history of these societies. You know, in the Soviet Union, for example, you know, they killed 20, 30 million of their own people, not lost in World War II, but during their purges, you know, because these people were considered counter-revolutionaries. And they were willing to sacrifice. They consider World War II to be a great victory, even though it cost 20 to 30 million more people to defeat Nazi Germany, because it's worth sacrificing 20 to 30 million people to keep communism and the revolutionary vanguard, who are the elites leading the Soviet Union, in power and alive and victorious. That sacrifice would be worth it, and was worth it to them. China killed even more of its own people. I think it was something like 60 million people they killed in the Cultural Revolution.
Oh, yeah.
For their own purges, for the purpose of purposes of their own revolutionary vanguard. And we all know what a murderer Kim Jong-un is in North Korea.
Well, it's interesting to note, too, that all of these things have to do with, you know, the communism that we're looking at that's all supposed to be so great. We'll be right back. We've got a hard break coming. You're listening to We the People at wethepeopleradio.us. You can catch us on the American Uncensored News Network in Redding, California, KRDT, channel 23.10, Tuesday and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. And welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Look at that. We did it just like we're supposed to.
Yep. Well, till then. Yeah.
Except for that part.
Yeah, except for that. Our sponsor this hour is Pappy Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. They handle everything John Deere as far as tractors, implements, you name it. They've got it down there. They also have the turf products, which are the riding mowers, zero-turn mowers. They have it all. Go down and see them. They've got it all in stock. And they also have Honda generators for when generator season is upon us. It could happen any minute.
You would think it would be winter.
Yeah.
But no, it's summer.
It's summer. So be prepared.
But they use them in the winter, too. What the heck?
Oh, yeah.
Live large.
Oh, yeah.
Have power all year long.
Yep.
Go crazy.
So you can go down and you can see them at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Give them a call at 226-9226 or get them on the web at pappemachinery.com. No, I wasn't going to say it.
You were.
Yeah, I was.
Phil loves my favorite website I invented a long time ago. RedingTractors.com because it's so easy.
Yeah. In fact, if you go to RedingTractors.com, you'll still end up at Pappy Machinery.
Ta-da!
Yeah, there you go.
Look at that.
Yep.
Full service. You can get there any way you want.
That's right.
Yeah, you could type in just, you know, Bill was talking about crap on the radio.
Yep, and
boom.
Boom, Pappy Machinery comes right up. Yep.
I don't think Google's working that hard for us these days. Actually, it's probably good because they're up to no good.
That's right. So who's our guest?
What was that?
Who's our guest?
Who's our guest?
Yeah, come on.
I was just for the record, I was not straggling Bill just right then. I actually can't reach him from here. So our guest this hour is the same guest as we had last hour. And if you missed it, you're blowing it. But go back to wethepeopleradio.us. We also have a whole bunch of shows. Goes back to 2017, December of 2017 to be accurate there. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. I like the whole name. Peter Vincent Pry. I don't know what your folks were thinking, but it's a great name. He's the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and the director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both are congressional advisory boards. He also served on the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, and the House Armed Services Committee. He was an intelligence officer with the CIA, responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy, which is why we're talking about that today. And just in case you thought, well, yeah, so he's some guy who hung around in Washington, D.C., and how does he know anything? Well, he has a PhD in history and archaeology, and then, well, you know, he was obviously an overachiever. So we thought he'd go get another one in strategic studies. And then the CIA said, hey, this guy seems smart. We should call him.
we should
call him up. He seems like a smart guy. We don't have so many of those all the time. And he's the author of numerous articles also and books. So I've got the articles posted that we're sort of referencing today. And I also listed a link here to his articles on Newsmax. He's got a whole bunch of those. So if you head to the site, you'll be able to find him. And also previous shows. We've done all sorts of fun things with him, and I'm sure we'll have all sorts of fun things in the future. It's really nice to talk to somebody who knows what they're talking about and then give them more than 2 minutes to talk about it.
And we've been talking about the nuclear threat between China and Russia and all the other little nations out there that want to have a bomb. You know, one of the questions that was kind of burning a hole in my brain was, you know, we were talking about Russia and China. Is there any chance the two of them could, you know, team up against the U.S.? I mean, they're both considered adversaries of the U.S. Do you think that would ever happen?
I think it has happened, and I think it has been a fact for many years now. But it's a fact that Washington hasn't seen, and I think official Washington still hasn't seen. And I don't know why they haven't, because, oh, more than a decade ago, there was a strategic partnership treaty signed between Russia and China. They have been, China's growth as a military giant is based not alone on stealing U.S. technology. Russia has been providing them with a lot of their most advanced technology, including for nuclear missiles. There's even a deal now to sell China the S-400, which is one of Russia's most advanced anti-air and anti-missile systems. They have done military exercises together, including, I think Vostok 18. I think that, which was probably, it may well have been the largest military exercise in world history that involved 300,000 troops and something like 20,000 vehicles of all kinds and thousands of aircraft. That was a joint exercise that involved China with Russia. And they've had other military exercises together. So they even did a nuclear war game together that involved a Taiwan scenario where China got in a dust-up with us. They were trying to take over Taiwan and Russia, and it escalated to a nuclear conflict where Russia came in on the side of China. So I think it's a fact. I think, and not only that, but I think that Russia and China, North Korea and Iran are all basically allied together. in this new Cold War that we face, people keep saying the new Cold War with China or the new Cold War with Russia. I think this new Cold War is against Russia and China, North Korea and Iran, in international terrorism, because Iran is the world's leading sponsor of international terrorism. And while these guys all have different ideologies and different goals, they are all united against the United States, you know, because they want to knock us off as the dominant actor in the world order and take over the world order and establish a new world order friendly to themselves and friendly to their interests. And that it will become a new Dark Ages because they will fall to fighting against each other to see who dominates it. But we may be long gone by the time that happens. So, I think that that is a very serious threat and that we would be very foolish and probably are being very foolish, mostly in Washington. There are some people who get it, that Russia and China are allied, but most Washington establishment still doesn't. They don't even understand that North Korea and China are allied. That, you know, we keep going back begging Beijing, before this crisis, before we got into a crisis with China, you know, in 2017 when we were in crisis with North Korea and they were making almost weekly nuclear threats against us, you know, the answer of the administration was to go to Beijing with hat in hand and beg them to try to lean on North Korea, to pressure North Korea to give up the bomb. And that didn't work. In fact, every administration has been trying that since Bill Clinton, and it's never worked. And when are we going to learn that it's because China wants North Korea to have the bomb? China is a surrogate for both Russia and North Korea is a surrogate for both Russia and China, so that if they had to go to a nuclear war, they could rely on North Korea to do it. But even beyond that, and this gets to another point about why I think nuclear weapons are such a threat to us, and not that the technology has not in the long run been in our interests. I think that the bad guys are winning this new Cold War against us without having to fire a shot because of the intimidating factor of nuclear weapons. I think they learned the lesson. China understood this lesson since Sun Tzu, the great pre-Christian military philosopher Sun Tzu, whose book on war says the greatest victory is to achieve the greatest the best victory is won without battle. You know, to win without fighting. And I for sure they learned this lesson when we won without fighting the Cold War. You know, we were able to prevail in the Cold War through nuclear deterrence, basically, that did keep the Soviet Union bottled up until it collapsed of its own weight. And they're trying to do the same thing to us, not to keep us bottled up in this, but to drive us out of certain areas. You know, that's why they gave North Korea nuclear capabilities. In addition to being able to have someone who would fight a nuclear war for them as a surrogate if that became necessary, I think the first and maybe foremost point of that was the intimidating factor, the nuclear blackmail factor, to raise the risks, to change our calculus of risks and benefits of providing security guarantees to our Pacific allies. And the Chinese have actually put it to us bluntly, also when we've had confrontations with them. A Chinese general once asked one of our representatives from the State Department, are we really willing to trade Los Angeles for Taipei? In other words, in order to defend Taiwan from a Chinese invasion, are we really willing to sacrifice Los Angeles, for example? And North Korea basically has been asking that same thing via its nuclear threats. Is it really worth it to us to risk a nuclear EMP attack that could fry all of North America, or losing a major American city to one of their ICBM strikes in order for us to protect Seoul and protect South Korea, to protect Japan, you know?
At that point, it would be nice to say, you basically can't hurt us because we've prepared for all these things, and God knows you've tried to help us get into that position, but for some reason we're still here, you know, we're still in the same hamstrung place. And, you know, for those people who haven't heard, you know, you speak on the EMP threat, maybe you could do the elevator part when we come back. You know, why don't we have that straightened out yet? And why is that still something they can hang over our heads? Because you would think that peace through strength thing that we figured out a long time ago would still be valid. And yet we're still rolling the dice. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People, and you can join us at wethepeopleradio.us. You can catch us on the American Uncensored News Network in Redding, California, KRDT, channel 23.10, Tuesday and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m.
I pray that you are here to stay. Anything you want, you got it. Anything you need, you got it. Anything at all, you got it.
Who is it?
Nothing's gonna get to me, but then again it might. What can I do to keep from going crazy in the night?
I thought I'd tee up the next part for you.
So,
because I bet you hear that playing in your head, you're like, "Oh my God, I keep telling them the same thing over and over, and they keep not listening."
What?
Why aren't they? Why are we still talking about how they could take us out with a, you know, with all these different things?
Okay, well, all right. On EMP, and I don't want to talk a lot about that because we've talked about that at great length before.
Right. I just thought
I haven't
we should...
actually gotten to my punchline yet.
Oh, dear.
Right. After almost an hour and a half or whatever it's been.
We'll stay on as long as it takes. Oh, wait. No,
okay. But on the EMP issue, you know, to give a short answer to that, and it's really hard to give a short answer to that because I wrote a whole book about that, as you know, The Power and the Light, that explains what the problems are, and there are many problems. But maybe the most obvious problem to listeners is just think of Dr. Fauci as being in charge of EMP protection for the country. And that explains why we are still vulnerable.
So bottom line is we can be saved by wearing goggles?
Well, no. Just,
no, I'm kidding.
Here's an arrogant, incompetent bureaucrat,
yeah,
who I think most Americans realize at this point has been wrong about almost everything.
Yeah.
And wasn't prepared for the coronavirus. The President of the United States had to step in. You know, billions of dollars invested, decades invested, supposedly getting ready for serious biological threats like biological warfare. And somehow the Washington establishment, the Washington bureaucracy, managed not to be prepared. You know, because there's deep corruption and incompetence. And the concept of the brilliant technocrat who's going to take care of us is a falsehood. You know, these people are dangerously incompetent, the concentrated power in Washington, dangerously incompetent. They've been dangerously incompetent on the coronavirus and unfortunately led our president into bad decisions like closing down the economy that actually poses risks beyond his. He might not get reelected as a consequence of that, but there are even more profound implications for, you know, our society coming apart at the seams and maybe one of our adversaries exploiting this moment of great American military and economic weakness. You know, we haven't been so vulnerable since 1939, 1940, 41, you know, before World War II. And maybe even more so because this is also the anniversary, it's the 75th anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but it's also the 80th anniversary of the fall of France in 1940. And there was a great book written by a French freedom fighter, a member of the resistance, a guy named Marc Bloch, who explained how was it that France fell in 1940, when even guys like Winston Churchill thought that the French army, you know, French army was not weak. It actually had more tanks than the Germans did. They had the Maginot Line. You know, Winston Churchill thought that the French would be able to win. But they fell. They collapsed. And Mark Bloch's theory And I have to add as a footnote, we only know what Mark Bloch thought about this. You know, his book was published after his death. As a resistance fighter, he was captured by the Nazis, by the SS, and executed. But his manuscript survived, and it was published after his death. And Mark Bloch's theory, and I think it's a true theory, is that the real reason, in addition to the military tactical things, obviously the French hadn't anticipated the Blitzkrieg, and the Germans, the way they used the technology of air power and armor was unanticipated by any of the Allies. And that is true, and that those are major physical reasons why they lost. But I think, Mark, a factor that we ignore at our peril, and maybe the most important reason they lost, okay, was that France had lost confidence in the idea of France. They lost confidence of themselves. France, before 1940, looked a lot like the United States does today. There were bitter battles going on between communists and people on the right, and you know, people felt the government was corrupt and incompetent. And they didn't regard World War I as a proud heritage, many of them, but saw it as a terrible failure of the French government, which it was in many respects. You know, in terms of the way the war was, they weren't ready for that one either, and it was so incompetently managed. But there were conspiracy theories about, you know, the war had been fought not to save France, but to enrich, you know, the merchants of death, as they were called. There was even a book of that title back then that was extremely popular, not just in France, but all over the West. And there were many of the same attitudes in France in 1940 that you'll find in the United States today, where people, the American idea, you know, is not supported by a majority of the population or all the population anymore. You know, and people, even in the face of the Nazi threat, the Nazi conquest of France, there were just many French who were willing to reach an accommodation and establish a Vichy government and go along, including generals who had fought in World War I, you know, Marshal Pétain. You know, these guys became Nazi collaborators. And and that is, that's a long way from your original question, but it's a point of vulnerability that we have that goes beyond the technological vulnerabilities I've been talking about, to nuclear weapons, to EMP, to these advanced systems and all the rest. The most important bulwark for our security, I think, just as it is for, would have been for France in 1940, or just as it would have been for any nation, is nationalism, you know, patriotism, that your adversary knows that the divisions stop at the water's edge, and that when they come after you, everyone is going to be united and defend the country, defend America like it's your mother. And if they don't believe that, and if it's not true, that is arguably an even more, a greater incentive for war, for aggression by the other side, than the imbalance in technological and numerical weaponry that we've been talking about.
And do you think we're projecting that position right now?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think I'm afraid we are. And we've actually had this experience in our history already. The Vietnam War, right? You know, here's a totalitarian communist state, a pygmy compared to us by any measure you would take. Militarily, they had no nuclear weapons, but they had persistence, and they were willing to sacrifice millions of their own people in that war. And they understood us. Their intelligence services and those of Russia and China that collaborated with them understood us well enough so that they, when 1968 came along, you know, that most historians point to that as the pivotal year in the Vietnam War. You know, that was the year of the anti-war protests and the disruption of the Democrat National Convention and the peak of the countercultural movement. You know, And that's why they decided to launch the Tet Offensive during that year. You know, that because we thought up to that point our political and military leaders had been telling us we'd been winning the war militarily. And it was true. We were winning the war on the ground. The bad guys even lost the Tet Offensive. They lost it decisively. But our own divisions and our lack of commitment to prevail in that war was understood by our adversaries. And it's why they launched that act of aggression then. And they were right. You know, it began. We didn't lose the war immediately in 1968, but it was the beginning of the end for us. You know, after that, after Nixon got elected, he realized he had to get us out of the war and hoped to salvage a honorable peace. And we ended up with a dishonorable peace with the helicopters flying off. So even a pygmy state like North Vietnam that doesn't have nuclear weapons can defeat us if we don't believe in America and don't believe in our cause anymore. The North Koreans tried it. They thought that they had the opportunity to do it in the Korean War. North Korea didn't have any nuclear weapons. They were so aggressive that they were willing to attack a nuclear-armed America, our ally, in South Korea, thinking they might be able to prevail because they were willing to sacrifice many more lives than we were. So they still think that way. And they've proven in their histories that they're willing to sacrifice countries like Russia and China, tens of millions, you know, in order to achieve their goals. And so I think that this is a... I don't know anybody. I've been in the national security field all my professional career. I'm 66 now. I've been studying this stuff since I was 13 years old. And I don't have any know any of my colleagues. All of my colleagues agree that we think this is the most threatened we've ever seen in the United States. You know, because we've got this constellation of actors who are working together against us in China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran, and international terrorists. And it's happening at a time when we have these profound doubts about the idea of America and deep divisions within our own country. In fact, that's even being kind. I've said on your show before, I think the Democrat Party has become a totalitarian movement itself. It has all the signs, all the earmarks of a totalitarian movement where it just cares about political power. It doesn't care about the truth. It doesn't care about the well-being of the country. It just wants to get political power and will do anything it has to get it. You know, we've never had a situation like that in the country before. We are so... No, it's within as well as from without.
Exactly. And it's so obvious right now, too. I mean, it's worse than it's ever been.
And the more we leave the technocrats in power, the more difficult it will become. So here would be the...
Well, let me give you some more bad news.
Hold on 5 seconds, because we've, again, need to celebrate capitalism while we, you know, I would say here's our message out to the Dr. Faucis of the world. You're listening to We the People.
Not capitalism. Capitalism is a Marxist term.
Exactly. That's true. Okay, so stop that. So we just have to take a break. We'll just leave it at that. Got to take a break. You can catch us on the American Uncensored News Network in Redding, California, KRDT, channel 23.10, Tuesday and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. Take that, Dr. Fauci.
Yeah, there you go. So, you know, we've talked about all the capabilities and what What do you think, or how far? I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what? How far do we have to? How far can we go with China before they're going to be in a position, or think they're in a position where a first strike is actually feasible and a real option for them? You see that coming?
I think a first strike is feasible and a real option for them right now, even if it's true that the balance is only, suppose it's true that the State Department is right and they've only got 300 weapons, okay? And we've got 1,500. I mean, one of the great fallacies of arms control that we have sort of hypnotized ourselves into believing is that, well, as long as we've got a lot more nuclear weapons than, let's say, China or North Korea, and the same number of nuclear weapons with Russia, which we don't, by the way, they have a vast, overwhelming superiority in all categories when it comes to nuclear weapons now. But that's always been a fallacy, the idea that that the other side is going to count our number of nuclear weapons and be deterred by that. Far more important to them is the issue of political will. You know, how important are the stakes? And, you know, because I don't think at the end of the day, or at least I hope that this is true of an American president, I don't think it is worth trading Taipei for Los Angeles, you know?
Right.
And I don't think most Americans believe that's worth it either, you know, that we would be willing to get into an exchange with these guys to protect the interests of our Asian-Pacific allies and sacrifice American lives in our homeland in large numbers.
But what they
think it was ever true. I don't think it was ever true that we were willing to do that for NATO Europe.
Right.
You know, we've got to that's why we tried to convince them that it was true by building up large numbers and maintaining parity with them. But that bluff, okay, becomes less and less credible as you don't even invest in the deterrent anymore. As you know, President Trump is trying to reverse that, but like I said before, it's going to be a decade before we start to see any new bombers or missiles, and even then they're going to be armed with obsolete warheads anyway. So this is a window of huge vulnerability. But the thing that concerns me, even more than that, is you see we're losing the new Cold War, even without a war. Right now we're losing it, and Americans don't seem to see that. Let me give you a few examples. The South China Sea, all right? China taking over the South China Sea is as big a geopolitical and geostrategic defeat for the West as if Russia took over Western Europe. That's how valuable the South China Sea is, okay, in the global chess game. It's that valuable. It's equal to, like, losing Western Europe. And they've done it. They take it over. They took it over without war. You know, the Hague Court has said that they've taken it over illegally. They said that years ago, but it hasn't changed China's mind. They haven't backed off. So we send a cut. We keep challenging them, and we've escalated the level of the challenge by sending. Now we've got two aircraft carrier groups that have gone in there to challenge them. But the fact of the matter is, they have taken over the South China Sea. They have de facto ownership of that property, and they did it. I think they did it under the cover. They know that because they're a nuclear power, that's a measure of our political will, that they've tested us in this new Cold War that's going on. You know, that we have not been willing to escalate to a military level, except for showing the flag. And, you know, because we don't want to get in a nuclear conflict with China. We don't want to get in a shooting conflict with China. Their conventional forces are too powerful in the South China Sea. Their nuclear forces, it just isn't worth it to us. It hasn't been yet, and I hope no president does go to nuclear war with China for the South China Sea. I think that would be the wrong decision. So they have called our bluff. They've started to call our bluff on this, all right? You know, which is why there's talk among our allies in Taiwan and Japan even. There are groups in South Korea about maybe we should get our own nuclear capabilities, you know, to state hold off these guys to make it credible. Another example is Guam. You know, North Korea back in 2017 repeatedly made threats against nuking Guam, you know, which is U.S. territory, And up until this year, it's where our most formidable, our best and most powerful card was located. You know, we had a B-52 wing based in Guam with aerial refuelers. And this was a big threat, a big part of the umbrella, the nuclear umbrella, against both China and North Korea. Now, we've pulled all that out of Guam. It's been pulled all out and sent back to Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. And the Air Force has put a happy face on that. They say, well, this is so that we can be even more flexible. And having our stuff in Minot is even better than it would be having it in Guam, okay? And the press hasn't challenged that or anything. But most Americans don't think deeply about these strategic matters. I promise you that North Korea and China have noticed that we've pulled those forces out of Guam, and that it has sent a message to them that despite the U.S. Air Force happy face, isn't fooling them, okay? Maybe it is possible that the Air Force did it. They don't care about the threats from North Korea or China, and that they're that naive, all right? But certainly the Chinese and North Koreans are going to think the reason we pulled out of Guam is because of them and because of that threat. This is exactly what Russia and China hope to accomplish by nuclearizing North Korea, that they would be able to win without war by forcing us out of the Pacific and reducing the credibility of our security guarantees to our Pacific allies. At some point, those Pacific allies are going to have to start asking themselves, am I better off being allied to the United States, or should I cut a deal with China, Russia, and North Korea and start buddying up with them? You know, because that would guarantee my security. You know, for sure, if I was friendly with China, surely they wouldn't let North Korea nuke me. You know, that would be the easiest, cheapest solution for them. We've got another thing happening as we speak, going on with Russia. We all know about Russia taking over Chechnya. We know about the Russia little green men in Ukraine, where basically they've been crucifying Ukraine to send a message to the NATO alliance that America's security guarantees and Britain's security guarantees are worthless, because we guaranteed the sovereignty of Ukraine in exchange for Ukraine giving up its nukes at the end of the Cold War, and obviously those security guarantees are worthless. And but we've got a new development here where Russian little green men have been found in Belarus. There's an election coming up in Belarus. Belarus has been in Russia's orbit. The president of Belarus, a guy named Lukashenko, very pro-Russian. He even wanted to have Belarus rejoin Russia and give up its sovereignty and become part of Russia. So Russia loves Lukashenko. But the people of Belarus have been increasingly unhappy under his regime. And there have been demonstrations, and there's going to be an election, you know, that might throw Lukashenko out, that might endanger him, which would endanger Russia's hold on Belarus. And Belarus, by the way, is very important to Russia because it's an invasion route into Poland and the Baltic states. And it connects them to the Russian enclave at Kaliningrad, too. That in itself is an issue for another topic. I mean, that's just, if you look at a map, you know, in the discipline of geopolitics, it's almost a predictor of future wars. When a state is not geographically contiguous, normal nation states are usually geographically contiguous, you know?
Right.
And look at Pakistan. There used to be this thing called East and West Pakistan, and now it's Balochistan. You know, Pakistan had a war with India to stop Balochistan from getting independent. And you've got Russia is not geographically contiguous. It's got Kaliningrad with Belarus in between, and Kaliningrad is in between Poland and the Baltic states. And then there's another little island that's occupied by the 14th Army down in Moldova, which is in southeastern Europe. So there's another little part of Russia that theoretically it's not really part of Russia, but it is because it's got the 14th Army on it. You know, just like Kaliningrad has got, you know, is a little fortress occupied by Russian forces. So now we've got these Russian little green men mysteriously appearing. Hundreds of them have been discovered in Belarus. So it looks like, you know, I mean, that's a very bold thing to basically, it looks like the KGB has been preparing for a coup d'etat to ensure that Lukashenko's regime will continue friendly to Russia.
Right.
And they don't care about what NATO is going to do with the United States or how this is going to look in world opinion, okay? But these are all examples of things where I think we're losing the new Cold War in the way the bad guys want, because nuclear weapons are that's what makes them most important, that you can actually win without war. Because when you do the calculations about, well, is it worth it for me to intervene in Ukraine? But if I do that in too big a way, maybe it'll anger Russia, and I don't want to get into nuclear war with Russia. How about South China Sea? Is it really worth it? Should I escalate from showing the flag to maybe trying to take back one of those islands? What happens if I get in a shooting war with China out there? They've got nuclear weapons. Same thing with Guam. Should we keep those guys out there with Kim Jong-un threatening to nuke Guam? Or do I move them to remove that tempting target? You know? And I think I don't want to put the one might say the bad guys certainly at least perceive this as America losing its nerve. I hate to phrase it that way because American politicians, I don't want to encourage reckless behavior, okay?
Right.
One could argue that this is prudent for us to be doing that because I don't think that it is worth sacrificing American lives for the geopolitical interests of our Asian Pacific allies. You know, we've been able to get away with this for many decades, but at the end, I don't want to sacrifice Los Angeles or Chicago for Taipei or Seoul, right? You know, at least I think that's
how
most Americans think, and hopefully that's what an American president will think when he calculates it. And this, too, puts us at a disadvantage. This is just a fact of geostrategy, you know, that nukes put us at this kind of disadvantage, and the bad guys have learned the lessons of the Cold War. And they're doing the same thing back against us, except now it's the forces of freedom that are losing.
Let's take a quick break, and because I think we just had a little bit of an international incident in Belarus or someplace over there.
Okay, so we're going to celebrate free enterprise this time. I have been misspeaking. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah.
You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us. You can catch us on the American Uncensored News Network in Redding, California, KRDT, channel 23.10, Tuesday and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m.
Up your boys, you've got to draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
All right, with T-minus 9 minutes.
Wasn't there a bunch of Russians arrested over there. I think they called them Russian contractors.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. Those are the little green men that I'm referring to.
Yeah.
Over 100 of them they found out about them. You know, fortunately for Belarusia, under Lukashenko, they're a totalitarian or authoritarian state too. So they've got a great secret police service. Apparently, maybe they didn't get the memo from Moscow, help these guys or ignore them or something. But anyway, yeah, they discovered that and they arrested a bunch of them. But there are supposed to be hundreds more. And what are they doing there? So, you know, it looks like another Crimea type thing going on. You know, and that's the kind of thing that can blow up into a war. But since we've only got 9 minutes, let me finally get to my punchline. And, because I think there is a technological way out of this bind. And I've made the argument before, think Ronald Reagan saw all of this and understood all of these strategic disadvantages that we had in the long run in the nuclear competition, which is why he started the Strategic Defense Initiative Program. You know, Reagan's vision, it wasn't just his vision, but it was Edward Teller and Albert L. Wallstetter and a lot of the great strategic minds, you know, of the Cold War also realized that we were at a disadvantage when it came to this. And what we needed to do was get beyond the technology of nuclear weapons to something else, to something that was better than nuclear weapons, to something that would be able to neutralize them and make them obsolete, and at the same time would be consistent with our own civilizational values, with our Judeo-Christian values, and that would be popular. And that was the idea of space-based missile defenses, or SDI, an example of which is Brilliant Pebbles, you know, which was a system. Contrary to what the left tells people, SDI actually did produce technologies that could achieve what Reagan wanted, that would have been able to intercept successfully large numbers of ballistic missiles. And Brilliant Pebbles is one of them. It was ready to go in 1993. A good friend of mine, Ambassador Henry Cooper, was the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Program when Brilliant Pebbles was ready to go. But Bill Clinton, for ideological reasons, because the Democrat Party has always loved the mutual assured destruction philosophy, they're, as a party, they have been ones who thought that deterrence, nuclear deterrence, will work forever, okay? And we don't want to upset the apple cart by defending ourselves. And so Clinton, not only did he nix Brilliant Pebbles, but he nixed the whole Strategic Defense Initiative and canceled it. And that's one of the things that many of us have hoped that President Trump had in mind by reestablishing the U.S. Space Force, that we would be moving toward resurrecting this idea of space-based missile defenses that would completely change the game we've been playing through the whole Cold War, so that defensive technologies would now have the advantage. The advantage wouldn't be with the guy who strikes first. It wouldn't be with the guy who has the most or better nuclear weapons. And we, instead, and our strategy, instead of being based entirely on the threat of delivering megadeaths against Russia or China or North Korea or Iran, it would be based on destroying their nuclear missiles and protecting the lives of our people. And it would be protecting the lives of their people, too, because it would make it unnecessary for us to make a nuclear retaliatory strike if it's successful. And Brilliant Pebbles, the technologies were proven. They weren't just on the drawing board. There were experiments done. We've actually, in fact, Elon Musk's space program incorporates a lot of the technologies that were used and developed in the Brilliant Pebbles and Strategic Defense Initiative space programs. You know, like these computers that are so good that a rocket booster doesn't have to be expended anymore. It can actually land itself. You know, that's actually derivative from one of the things that came out of SDI. So that could be the way out. And, you know, and it could be done pretty quickly, much more quickly than we can modernize the nuclear deterrent, and more cheaply, too. You know, 5 years, it'd probably take us about 5 years to deploy a Brilliant Pebbles system, and it could be done for $20 billion. And, you know, we're planning to spend over $1 trillion over the next decade on modernizing our nuclear deterrent. I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that, but at the end of the day, after a decade and spending $1 trillion, we're still going to be far behind the Russians and probably behind the Chinese. And these same problems with nuclear deterrence and nuclear weapons that are sort of inherent to our civilizational differences and to our geostrategic calculations. You know, is it worth the candle to sacrifice Los Angeles for Taipei or Seoul or Tokyo are still going to be with us. That won't have solved the problem. But Brilliant Pebbles, space-based missile defenses, that can solve the problem. And that's the way out of this bind. And I just hope President Trump does get a second term and does it. It's something the Democrat Party shows no interest in, never has. And, you know, although that would be another way of us being saved, put quotes around that. Because, you know, if we become a tyranny, a one-party system, like Russia and China and North Korea, they might not feel that they need to take us out anymore. You know, this is sort of the attitude that Sparta had during the Peloponnesian War, when in its conflict with Athens. when they finally defeated Athenian democracy and their and the Delian League, which was the other democratic states allied with Athens, the Spartans didn't destroy them. They just made them into tyrannies. And it wasn't the existence of the states that they feared as much as the existence of a free political system. On the other hand, our modern totalitarian states and personalities like Kim Jong-un are not as merciful as the Spartans were. So I'm not sure I put even high hopes at that. I think they're more like Hitler and Stalin and Mao Zedong, who, even if you agree, even if you're willing to be a tyranny, that might not be enough for them. You know, if you have enough autonomy so that you're not completely enslaved to them, you know, that's enough for them perhaps to decide to take you out, you know, regardless of what your political system is like.
Yeah, that's, you know, I never thought of that before, but you're right. If we did go to a one-party system, we'd be just like the bad guys.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Which is something
that
they
get along.
They all claim that they don't want and yet strive really hard to achieve.
Oh, my goodness. Anyone who has had to try to go through a program in one of our universities today, I'm sure, even back in the 80s, you know, when I was going to graduate school, just graduating in the early 80s, you know, after which I took my first job in Washington, it was like a one-party totalitarian system. Even in the early 80s, conservative professors had to hide under their desks. If we had conversations, it was behind a closed door, you know, and it's 1,000 times worse today.
Well, and now
there aren't any conservative professors left.
Sure,
yeah.
And it's bled out into the rest of our society. I mean,
right.
We had a whispered conversation with a waitress yesterday. I mean, how silly is that? Well, Bill was wrangling with the large Marge there about the masks. All righty, we have, believe it or not, burned through our whole 2 hours. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Been very educational.
I apologize for being late and picking up the
phone. No worries. Bill takes heart medication, and mine appears to be fine. So, you know, not a panic.
Yeah.
Well, I knew that your sense of humor and ability to be like a stand-up comic
we'll do our
would fill in for me. So thank you again for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you. You've been listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. You can catch us on the American Uncensored News Network in Redding, California, KRDT, channel 23.10, Tuesday and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m.